Hello and welcome. You are tuned into another edition of Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. I'm your host, Tony Doman, and here on this program, each and every week, I find and feature themes relating to Appalachian culture, and then I play songs and feature stories all about our topic of choice. Well, today I've got a great show lined up and ready for you. Today I'll be featuring a conversation with Ian Kirkpatrick and Sheila K. Adams. They'll be joining me to talk about the Folk and Traditional Arts Cross-Border Mentor Apprenticeship Program through South Arts. They'll be talking about their mentor and apprenticeship experiences, which focused on ballad singing in Appalachia, a tradition that goes back to the earliest Scottish and English settlers to the area. So please stick around and stay tuned for today's program. It's one that you don't want to miss and features the wonderful story of the mentor apprenticeship between Sheila and Ian. First up, here's one of my favorite versions of an Appalachian ballad, The Devil's Nine Questions by Elizabeth Lepreau.
Now you must answer my questions nine. Sing 99 and 90, or you aren't God, you are one of mine. And who is the weaver's bonnie? What is whiter than the milk? Sing 99 and 90, and what is softer than the silk? And who is the weaver's bonnie? Snow is whiter than the mill. Sing 99 and 90, and down is softer than the sill. And I am the weaver's bonnie. What is higher than a tree? Sing 99 and 90, and what is deeper than the sea? And who is the weaver's bonnie? Heaven is higher than a tree. Sing 99 and 90, and hell is deeper than the sea. And I am the weaver's bonnie. What is louder than a horn? Sing 99 and 90, and what is sharper than a thorn? And who is the weaver's bonnie? Thunder's louder than a horn. Sing 99 and 90, and death is sharper than a thorn. And I am the weaver's bonnie. What's more innocent than a lamb? Sing 99 and 90, and what is meaner than womankind? And who is the weaver's bonnie? A babe's more innocent than a lamb. Sing 99 and 90, and the devil is meaner than a womankind. And I am the weaver's bonnie. Now you have answered my questions nine. Sing 99 and 90, so you are God's, you are none of mine. And you are the weaver's bonnie.
Was in the town of Knoxville I used to live and dwell. And in that little Knoxville town I owned a flour mill. I fell in love with a Knoxville girl with dark and rolling eyes. I promised her I'd marry her if me she'd never deny. I called on her sister's house about 9 o'clock one night. And on that little townhouse porch I hugged her with a smile. I asked her to take a walk with me down to the meadow gate, that we might have a social talk and name our wedding day. We walked along, we talked along, till we come to the meadow gate.
All right, a little bit of the Knoxville Girl, an unaccompanied ballad there from one of our guests today, Ian Kirkpatrick. Ian is an accomplished ballad singer who grew up in Claiborne County, Tennessee, and he grew up learning ballads as secular songs from his gospel singing family. We're also talking with another guest today, Sheila K. Adams, here on the program. Sheila K. Adams is a former North Carolina Heritage Award and National Heritage Award recipient, and she's been singing the ballads she learned from her family for over 60 years. She's also an accomplished storyteller and banjo player. Together, Sheila and Ian were part of a recent group of mentors and apprentices through the Folk and Traditional Arts Cross-Border Mentor Apprenticeship Program from South Arts. The program is specifically designed to support mentor artists and apprenticeship relationships that cross state borders in order to develop shared cultural heritage in Central Appalachia, all working towards preserving folk traditions that they are passing down across generations. So we are going to go ahead and get on into our conversation with Ian and Sheila that was recorded just a few weeks ago here for this program. We're going to be talking about their relationship with the mentor and apprenticeship and their experience and work in doing this program. So I'm so excited to get to speak with them for today's program. It's a great conversation, and I do hope you'll stick around and stay tuned, because we also have more ballad singing examples all through this hour. So stick around and stay tuned. We're going to get on into that conversation. So joining me now is Sheila K. Adams and Ian Kirkpatrick. They are here to talk about several things. Together, they are the recipients of the Folk and Traditional Arts Cross-Border Mentor Apprenticeship through South Arts. That is a mouthful. This is a program which supports mentors and apprentices in sharing their work, and it really highlights the importance of different traditions which they are passing down through the generations. As a mentor-apprentice team, Sheila and Ian focus on traditional ballad singing. So welcome to you both. I'm so excited to get to speak with you, both of you, this afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Tony. Glad to be
here. Thanks, Tony.
Okay, so Sheila K. Adams is a storyteller, author, musician from Madison County, North Carolina. And Ian, you are from Claiborne County, Tennessee. And also, your bio tells me, I know we know each other from a few other things here recently that we've done together, but your bio tells me you're an accomplished clogger turned ballad singer.
Yeah, that was sort of actually how I met Sheila. In 2013, I went to college at Mars Hill University, which was Mars Hill College when I applied. And by the time I was accepted, it was Mars Hill University, to join the Bailey Mountain Cloggers. And we did a lot of folk festivals and competitions in the region. And one day I was backstage and looked over and, oh my God, there's Sheila K. Adams. I have to go say hi to her. And we formed a really good friendship. And eventually I actually essentially retired from clogging. After you get, after you graduate the program. But I'm still singing. And I was very excited to apply for this internship, apprenticeship with Sheila this year.
Yeah, so that's really interesting about the clogging. I didn't know you could retire from it. It kind of seems like a lifelong thing. But what sparked your interest in traditional ballad singing, and how did it all get started with you just told me how you found Sheila and kind of figured that out, but how did this whole thing get rolling for you to do this together?
Yeah, so my family has actually been singing mostly gospel tunes, but every now and then they would throw a folk song in there for about six generations now that we've actually went back and looked. The problem with that is we don't know that sixth generation, who the seventh generation even is. All those records were burnt in the courthouse fires in Claiborne County, and so we can only go back that far. But when I started at Mars Hill, one of the first things I did was go to the Ramsey Center, which is the regional studies. Well, it's Appalachian Studies Center now. It used to be the regional studies program. And asked them for their folk song records, because I was looking for a song that my great grandfather sang to my grandmother growing up, and she sang it to me, but she could only remember the first verse and the chorus. So I was looking for the rest of those words, and essentially the Ramsey Center asked everywhere that they had access to, and they could not find it. So that is sort of my impetus for starting this journey and learning all these other songs that I'm trying to preserve alongside them.
Did you ever get anywhere with finding the rest of that song, or?
I never did. Sheila and I talked about it a couple of years ago, and we sort of came to the conclusion that if he didn't, the way the words were, and the timing and the rhythm and all these different things, it sounded like something the Carter family would have collected. And we sort of come to the conclusion that if he didn't write it, someone in that community did around that same time period.
Wow. That's really interesting. And it's also really interesting to think about all the other people that might have kind of snippets of songs that they can't find or have kind of gotten lost through time as well. That's a really interesting way for you to come to ballad singing and yeah, as you put it, start this journey. I love that. So Sheila, you were in education in the North Carolina public school system for many, many years. Is this the first time you've taken on a role as a mentor? And why do you feel it's so important to have programs like this is a program through South Arts? Why do you think it's so important to have these kind of mentor apprenticeship programs out there available to keep these folk traditions alive?
Well, my feeling is that always before Tony, I was working mainly with family members. And so when Ian approached me to do an apprenticeship with him, I decided, well, Ian looks enough like my family to where we could plop him down right in the middle of a family reunion and he would fit right in. They'd be asking him, whose boy was he? Which one of them boys was your daddy? And two, as Ian said, we'd developed this friendship. And so we kind of started off on, we were going to get together, you know, at least a couple of times a month, and then COVID hit. And so we were then doing things on Zoom, which I came to really appreciate with Ian, because he, for one thing, he knew how to do it and I didn't. And so I've learned a lot. But the other thing with Ian is that, like all good apprentices, he had an idea that, and when he presented it to me, there was no way that I could say no, because he had a community in Claiborne County that he had discovered a bunch of ballad singers that were singing back during the time of Cecil Sharp. And Cecil Sharp wrote a book called Folk Songs of the Southern Appalachians, English Folk Songs of the Southern Appalachians. And he traveled all up and down through the Southern Appalachians collecting these songs, and Claiborne County, Tennessee was one of the ones that Ian or I mean where Ian lives, that was one of the ones that Sharp went through and collected these songs. So when Ian said, well, how would you feel about me going through and finding the songs, the versions that Sharp collected while he was here, because I came to find out that he actually knew pretty much all of the songs that he had ever heard me sing anywhere out, you know, in public, and he had learned a bunch of songs that Bobby McMillan, a good friend of mine, who will be 70 years old this year, that's hard to believe, but, and it's kind of the two of us are now in the position of being the resources. And when I realized that Ian knew most of my songs and several of Bobby's, well, it made more sense for him to find the songs, the versions that were collected by Sharp in the teens, 19 teens, by Cecil Sharp. And so that's what he did. And it's been a real education for me as well, because I have found through Ian singing all of these great songs, he's been a pleasure to work with. And as far as why is it important, it's important because Cecil Sharp predicted it would have died out by 1950 because of the industry and all coming in. And education, he said, was usually a big detriment to industry and education were detriments to the true culture into which one is born.
Wow.
So anyway, it's been an interesting journey for me, and I think I've probably learned more than Ian has. But aside from that, he's just been an absolute dream to work with.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned Cecil Sharp. A few years ago here at the Birthplace of Country Music Museum, I'm in my house right now, so not here, but a few years ago in I think 2018 or early 2019, we had a traveling exhibit that was about Cecil Sharp's photographs, and it was incredible. There were several people, visitors to the museum, that would come in that recognized some of the spaces, some of the places that just, I don't know, it just blew my mind, because that's over 100 years ago now, that he came to the Appalachian region and did song catching, collected photographs. Or took photographs, rather. And so, I mean, there was at least two or three times whenever I was there that people were saying, that's on my farm or that's on my home place. So it's all connected. But Ian, I really love that you are taking the Cecil Sharp songs and doing them and performing them. What are some of the activities or things that you all do together as mentorship and apprentice? Kind of tell me so you're a mentorship and apprentice. Yeah, what do you do with that? I imagine there's performances involved.
Well, for one thing, I listen a lot. So Ian, do you want to address that?
Yeah, so one of the first questions I had for Sheila was, how do you start a song? Because it's a problem I've had since I started singing. If I can start it, I can finish it. But if I don't start it at the right spot, it goes south real quick. So a lot of our apprenticeship was working on just finding the keys, the notes and things like that, that work for my voice. Because ballad singing is a very individual activity. You always sing solo, you always sing a cappella, and that can be very difficult. I didn't go into this trying to sound like Sheila K. Adams. Mm-hmm. I went into this trying to sound like me, maybe singing her songs, but singing them in the way that I would do that. So the traditional way of teaching that is called knee-to-knee style instruction, I guess, if we wanted to give it a more formal language. Sheila would sit right in front of me. Our knees would be touching, like face to face. And she would sing a verse of a song, and then I would repeat it back to her. And then she would sing the second verse of the song, and then I would repeat the first and the second. And it would keep going like that until she was only singing one verse and I was singing 50.
Yeah, they're long songs, most of them. Yeah.
And, you know, occasionally I would forget a word and then we would have to go back and start all over. So it's a very long process of learning these songs. But, you know, if you get someone dedicated who's interested in it, like I am, and stubborn as a mule, eventually I did figure out some of them. Not all of them, but some of them. But as far as performances, yes, we did our showcase last month, I think. It was a virtual showcase with South Arts, and you can find that on Facebook at South Arts website. You can also find it on YouTube. And then last Friday, as of this taping, we did a show at the Madison County Public Library, mm-hmm. in conjunction with Melanie, Sheila's daughter, because they were doing a grant on their own through the North Carolina Arts.
Yeah, so why don't we talk a little bit about some of the history of ballad singing, and both of you can feel free to kind of jump in. Obviously, it has a very rich history, and we can't get into the whole thing, but what did you all kind of focus on during your apprenticeship? Is there a certain time period or a certain more Appalachian kind of ballads, I would imagine?
Yeah, so the ballad singing tradition started in the 1200s, and I'm going to zip up into the 1800s just to make it faster. They came over from England and France and other areas of basically Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and brought those songs with them into the region, and the ballad singing tradition continued to grow as those new stories developed, because basically what a ballad is a song that tells a story, and it is typically about historical events that you can actually go back and, you know, read the newspaper articles about the actual activity that you're singing, the event that you're singing about. So when Cecil Sharp came in 1917 to my part of the region, he came in 1916 to Sheila's part, that sort of is where we started, because that collection is one of the biggest. And it included songs from both parts of both regions that we were from. So 1917 was really our start date, and his collection started this big wave of collectors to the southern central Appalachian region. In Claiborne County, there were two other collectors, Artis Moser, and I'm going to butcher this, C.P. Cambier. That's how a mountain person speaks French. And they collected in the 30s and the 40s a lot of the same songs and even more songs that had become popular on the radio, as this was the early days of the radio, from their students. Artis Moser started collecting folk songs because in Tennessee, his students said, that they knew better versions of the songs that he was trying to teach them from their textbook. So he started collecting those versions. And later he moved back to Swannanoa in Western North Carolina and became the Artis Moser that we know today. But this was before he was given a record player by the federal government. And he wrote, he sent all his collection into Mellinger Henry, and they published a book. And C.P. Cambier collected from a lot of the same people and wrote another book. And it's funny because Sheila said, you know, Cecil Sharp thought that education was going to be one of the downfalls of the ballad singing tradition. Well, all four singers that he collected from in Claiborne County were students at the university. And the songs they sang were the songs their grandparents sang to them. And when Moser and Cambier came through, they were collecting from students at the university who had learned it from their grandparents. So academia has always had an aspect in the ballad singing community. You go to any university in the South, and they will probably have a ballad singing collection from somebody. But there's a fourth person that carried it into the 1950s, which is right when Cecil Sharp's thought that the ballad singing tradition would die off as 1950. So you're looking at that sort of period in this project. And his name was Tillman Cadle, and he was actually born in Claiborne County. He spent most of his life in eastern Kentucky, right over the line in Bell County, Middlesboro, as a coal miner. But he was born in Claiborne County, and he's the only collector that I know of that was born in that area and collected from that area. And him and his future wife, Mary Elizabeth Barnacle, she was from New York, and they helped found Jim Garland and his siblings, Aunt Molly Jackson and Sarah Obin Gunning, who became, I mean, the influence for Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and all of those big 20th century revivalist names that we know of. So, what was your question?
Well, we're just talking about history. You can keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't stop.
Yeah. No, it's great.
But it's funny because after Cadle, those ballad collectors really stopped coming to Claiborne County. They continued to come to Madison County, where Sheila's from, but they kind of stopped coming to the Cumberland Gap area. And it didn't stop the locals from singing. We have so many contributions to so many various genres of music that those singers come from Claiborne County. But there hasn't been a really big ballad hunt in Claiborne County since about the 1950s.
In Scarlet Town, where I was born, there was a fair maid dwelling, made every youth cry well a day. And they called her Barbary Allen. It was in the month of May, when all gay flowers were a-blooming, sweet William on his deathbed lay, for the want of Barbary Allen. He called his servant to his bed, and bade him quick, I leave him, to fetch that fair maid to his side, that fair maid Barbary Allen. He searched high and he searched low, till at last he drew nigh her, saying, pretty fair maid, come fly with me. If your name be Barbary Allen, slowly she got up, and slowly she drew nigh him. But all she said at his bedside was, young man, I think you're dying. Don't you recall last Saturday night, when we was all at the tavern, you raised a toast to the ladies all, but you slighted Barbary Allen. Yes, I remember last Saturday night, when we gathered at the tavern, I gave a toast to the ladies all, but my heart to Barbary Allen. Oh, take it back, I'll keep it not. You've slighted me so sorely. Come Saturday night in the tavern near,
I'll serve you just as poorly. He turned his face all towards the wall. A sigh it did escape him. That night sweet William breathed his last. From the loss of Barbary Allen, as she was riding through the town, she heard the death bells tolling, and with each stroke they seemed to say, hard-hearted Barbary Allen. Oh, mother, make up my bed. Make it both long and narrow. Sweet William died for me last night. I'll die for him tomorrow. They found her there the very next morn. As though she's sweet, lies sleeping, with a note that said farewell to all. I'm finished with my grieving. They buried William in the old graveyard, and Barbary they laid nigh him, and out in his grave grew a blood-red rose, and out in hers a briar. They grew and grew to the graveyard gate, where they could grow no higher, and there they tied in a true lover's knot, with the rose wrapped around the briar.
Barbary Allen there from Sheila K. Adams. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. And today we are talking with guests Ian Kirkpatrick and Sheila K. Adams, who are part of a mentor apprenticeship program through South Arts. They are here talking about their experience being a mentor and being an apprentice through this program and focusing on traditional ballad singing. So we are going to go ahead and get on into the second part of our conversation.
Do you all kind of know why the thought, going back a little bit, like the thought that this will die out by this certain time period, why people may have thought that? Because, you know, a lot of people that I talk to, even just for different subject areas on this program, I always talk about how traditions are, it's so important for things to be passed down and things like you, what the both of you are doing, so it's preserved for a future generation. But some people even say, hey, the threat of folk traditions disappearing is not going to happen because so many people are, there are so many things happening to preserve them and to promote them right now in this moment. So what are your thoughts on that? Why do you think that people kind of felt like they were going to die out 60, 70 years ago almost now? And here we are today in 2021, and they're still really thriving in a lot of ways, and a lot of people are doing a lot to promote them.
Well, with my family, my parents' generation, Tony, didn't at all maintain this tradition. They threw it away because it was a part, for them, it was a part of the culture that spoke to poverty. Mm. And so that old way of singing. But when I came along, I started spending time with the older people, and I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was hyperactive as a child, and so they had to have some way to keep me occupied, and I loved stories. But Ian is exactly right in that for some reason they did keep coming to Madison County. And I can tell you one thing based on his research that he's done and all the songs that he has found, they should have been going back to Claiborne County as well, which is something that you and I might think about doing, Ian, actually, seeing if there's still some of it left.
Yeah, I'd love to go into the local community and do some, you know, archival collecting work. I know of
several... I've got a question for Ian. Why do you think that you really wanted to learn this tradition, Ian? I mean, what about it moved? Because the old folks used to tell me that you didn't choose to learn the ballads. They chose for you to learn them.
Well, that's an interesting question, Sheila. there is sort of a feeling of, well, this is what my family does. You know, some people are woodworkers, some people are metallurgists. I'm a singer. My family has sung, like I said earlier, for six generations in some form or another. So you're right, in a way. You know, I didn't really choose this. It chose me. And I hope to find someone else who gets chosen or does decide. Someone who actually does choose this. I would like to see who that person is.
I don't think it's ever going to happen, and I think what's going to happen is it's going to keep choosing people as it goes along, because the tradition is still going fairly strong. But it's not, of all the traditions, like the dance, the old-time music, you know, playing of instruments and singing and that sort of thing, I don't think that's ever going to disappear. Because there's a lot of flash and dazzle with that stuff, but a ballad that's got 27 verses to it, or 42 verses to it, or some of them even upwards toward 100 verses, are not all that appealing to a lot of folks, because our attention span has shrunken down to where it's about 7 seconds long now. And so if we don't catch somebody, which Ian can do, I've heard him do it, catch somebody within the first 7 seconds, well, then you've lost them throughout the whole, you know, however long it's going to take, 7, 8, 10 minutes to sing this song, you've already lost them. But I haven't seen Ian lose anybody yet.
Ballads were like the TV of the time. And now we have TV and video games and all of this technology. And I think that was really the big scare for these collectors and singers, is that, well, they have something else to do now to occupy their time. They're not going to pay that much attention to, you know, music and dance and culture. And to an extent, you know, I have seen shortening of some of the songs, and that's one thing I would like to do, is to bring back some of those longer songs. But, you know, on the other hand, when you're doing this for a live audience, you want to make sure that they get something out of it, that they are entertained. And so this aspect of performance versus just singing around the house like it used to be done has changed the ballad tradition in many ways that I don't think are very obvious at first look.
Yeah. Well, and could y'all touch a little bit about on, so we're talking a little bit about the history of ballad singing here, some of the subject matter and the audience, I guess, throughout the time period that you all kind of kept your apprenticeship focused on. And there was also we'll talk about your all's The Great Divide, the blog page here in just a sec, but there was a section on there about misheard lyrics that I thought was really interesting that I was reading right before we hopped on the call here. Can you kind of touch on those points a little bit? I know that when you're dealing with a song with 27 verses, maybe over time some things might be heard a little differently between audiences or between singers. Is that kind of common, I would assume?
Yeah, every singer had their own version of the song. Sometimes the words were different, sometimes the tunes were different. Sometimes they only remembered the first 5 verses, and that was as much of the story as you got from them. But I think back in the day, there wasn't really an audience. It was singing it to yourself to pass time away. Now, if someone else was listening, that was nice. But that wasn't your intention. It was to entertain yourself. And that's where you get these misheard lyrics or misremembered lyrics, because they're not really worried about, you know, presenting an accurate story. They're interested in entertaining themselves. And if the story gets muddled, well, that's okay a little bit. Now, you're going to try not to do that. But but yeah, you bring up so the website is called granddivide.com, but the project is Across the Great Divide. And that is where, hopefully, by the end of the summer, there will be a CD up of the songs I've been working on. Right now, you can check out a blog of the various things we have discussed throughout this apprenticeship. And the misheard lyrics is one of my favorite too on the blog, because it talks about the Lady Mondegreen, which is laid him on the green, is how it was supposed to be said. And the collector heard Lady Mondegreen, and that's how they wrote that down, and that's how it is. No. Now, that song in particular is the Earl of Murray, and it's not particularly popular in Appalachia. There's only one version of it that I have found, and it's from Western North Carolina, actually, that has been collected. Traditionally, there are a couple of other songs that me and Sheila have talked about that same sort of phenomenon of, you know, just all of a sudden there's a line that makes absolutely no sense, and trying to go back and finding out what that original line was, thanks to these collections and the collectors who wrote down the lyrics as they heard them. Now, sometimes they were wrong too, because, you know, accents and different ways of speaking. But, you know, thanks to those collections, we can go back and say, no, you know, this is how it's supposed to be.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we are running out of time here. We only have a few minutes left. I know it just flies by every time I talk to anyone. So can you tell me a little bit about, so we're still experiencing living through this pandemic. Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges or even maybe successful things because of the pandemic? I know, Sheila, you mentioned being able to utilize Zoom more. I found that I can really connect with people anywhere and everywhere. It's something I wasn't able to do beforehand just because technology. Was it kind of difficult doing this apprenticeship during a pandemic? How did that kind of affect what it could have been possibly and versus what ended up happening?
For me, it was just that I didn't get to see Ian as often as I would have chosen to. I thought, and inaccurately so, that we wouldn't form that close personal bond that you have to have between a mentor and an apprentice, or just between, as Granny used to call it, somebody that's being learned them old love songs. There was a certain way of doing things that I just had to get over, basically. And it took me, I struggled with it for a while, but Ian and I did have about 3 or 4 meetings together. And then we've spent probably more time actually in person together in the last couple of months than we did during that whole time. Wouldn't you think, Ian? Because yeah, we've seen a lot more of each other in the last couple of months, which has been wonderful. But again, thanks to Ian, and I'm sure that he would have preferred the non-Zooming time together as well, but he'll never be too far from my heart now, I can tell you that much.
I think COVID really impacted the way this project was done because, you know, there is a loss of that in-person engagement, but we can, because it's solo, we can still sing and, you know, repeat it back to each other. There's a little bit of a lag on Zoom. But other than that, it actually, you know, I'll talk about one of the benefits of it is that all of a sudden, all these programs were vastly more available online and so much easier to approach and ask for materials. I don't think I would have found half as much of the songs that I did without COVID because I would have had to have physically gone to these places, talked to somebody. It would have been a longer process. But during COVID, I was able to just send out an email and they were like, yeah, we're in the process of digitizing that right now. I'll send it over.
Yeah.
Well, the other amazing thing, Tony, is that Ian has joined about, I don't know. I know of at least three ballad swaps that they have on, that they've been having on Zoom. I think haven't you been to on the one in Boston, Massachusetts, Ian?
There's one that's hosted in Boston. It's international for attendees. There's one in the sort of the Great Divide area, the Tennessee, Western North Carolina. People have our own one because we didn't realize that it was going on globally and we formed our own. And then there's another one on the Mudcat website that they host one too. So it really is a worldwide phenomenon.
And too, Ian, we just received an invitation to join a ballad swap in the UK, in Scotland, Wales, and England.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he and I just got. Let's go do that. But we've been invited to be a part of their swap over there, so that's a huge compliment.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time here for today's program, but thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with me. And where can folks go right before we get off the air here? Where can folks go to learn more about what you're doing in addition to your all's website, a great Divide, correct?
They can go to granddivide.com.
Grand Divide. Awesome. Well, thank you again so much, Ian and Sheila. You all take care.
Thank you, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
George Collins rode home one cold winter night. George Collins rode home so fine. George Collins rode home one cold winter night. He took sick and died. A fair young lady in her father's house. A fair young lady so fine. But when she heard that George was dead, she threw herself down and cried. Oh, daughter, don't weep. Oh, daughter, don't moan. There's more pretty boys than one. But mother dear, he has my heart, and now he's dead and gone. She followed him up, she followed him down, she followed him to his grave. She fell down on her bended knees, she wept, she moaned, she prayed. Unscrew the coffin, lay back the lid, roll over the linen so fine, and let me kiss them pale, cold lips, for I know they'll never kiss mine.
All right, another ballad there from our guest Ian Kirkpatrick, George Collins there. And thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, you can catch this program, Mountain Song and Story, every Thursday at 4 o'clock right here each and every week on Radio Bristol. You can also check out past programs if you visit the Mountain Song and Story blog page over at listenradiobristol.org. Go check it out. I'll have today's materials, like today's songs, more about what Sheila K. Adams and Ian Kirkpatrick are up to these days, including their website. So go check it out to learn more. Special thanks once again to Sheila K. Adams and Ian Kirkpatrick for taking the time to speak with me today. Once again, my name's Toni Doman. You're listening to Mountain Song and Story, and I will catch you right here next week.
All out on your railroad, all out on the sea, all out on your railroad, far as I can see. Swing and turn, jubilee, live and learn, jubilee. Hardest work I ever done, working on a farm. Easiest work I ever done, swinging my true love's arm. Swing and turn, jubilee. If I had me a needle and a thread, fine as I could sew, sew my true love to my side, down this creek I'd go. Swing and turn, jubilee, live and learn, jubilee. If I had no horse to ride, I'd be found a-crawling up and down this rocky road, looking for my darling. Swing and turn, jubilee, live and learn, jubilee. Some will come on Saturday night, some will come on Sunday. If you give them a half a chance, they'll be back on Monday. Swing and turn, jubilee, live and learn, jubilee. I won't have no weirder man, neither will my cousin. You can get such stuff as that for 15 cents a dozen. Swing and turn.